Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, I'm glad we're here because if we were not here, if we were both executed, the number would be 236.
That was kind of a high point, wasn't it? Wasn't that interesting?
Applauding.
The audience, utterly unbidden, applauded at the news of how many people had been executed in Texas last year. I had no idea that Simi Valley had so much animus about people in Texas.
But I do have some. I do have some tape of people applauding the fact that the podcast is on this week. Listen. You like that?
That's good. I thought that was more applause than I was expecting.
Yeah.
Actually, let me just say that people in Texas have also been known to applaud at the news of how many people had been executed in Simi Valley.
You know who seemed to... There are some people who did not survive Simi Valley, and I wonder if Michelle Bachmann is among them.
You know, I thought that there was something about her last night that recognized, and I had previously not thought she was this politically astute, but something about her last night seemed to recognize she was done. Did you have that sense?
Well, what's so remarkable about this whole thing is that when she first announced her candidacy and was in that debate, she was the flavor of the month. She was going to win the Iowa caucuses. She was going to prove a possible nominee. She was going to upend the whole cart and everything. And now she just seems so eclipsed by Rick Perry and the focus on Romney versus Perry.
That's right. And the media love a two-person race, two-horse race. That's what we always go for. We can tolerate
a third.
But
as a junkie, don't you want a million candidates? You don't want a brokered convention, Ron?
Yeah, but as a news manager.
Don't you remember 52?
Look, when people have to start deciding whom they're going to cover and how many reporters are going to be sent out to do it, you've seen this over and over.
But as a junkie,
a huge prejudice toward a two-horse race. There will be a tolerance for a three-horse race for a period of time. There's no chance of a four-horse race. So if you look at this field, and Romney and Perry have both been front runners, they both have had over 20% of the vote at some point or another in the polls, and they obviously both have enormous resources in terms of money, and they are seen as plausible nominees in a way that Michelle Bachmann never was. But I think she still has a potentially key role to play here, which is she needs to stay in this thing to take votes away from Perry, or he's going to run away with it, unless Sarah Palin gets in, and I think we need to rethink the Sarah Palin equation.
Oh, please.
And number two, unless he has a lot of moments like the ones we saw toward the end of last night's debate. Yes, Rick Perry has all the assets, but he could blow it if he's going to, wander away mentally the way he did a couple of times last night.
Several things. First of all, you said she needs to stay in
to take votes away.
Well, but no candidate stays in a race to benefit another candidate. I mean, Michelle Bachmann obviously has to decide for herself whether she's a viable candidate, whether she has a chance for the nomination, whether her presence in the debate and the campaign make a difference. You also said something earlier about, look, if you're a political director and you have a certain finite number of staff.
Talking about the media here now.
The media, right, exactly. To send out, of course, you want a limited field because you can't afford.
And by the way, I will resist all of your attempts in the media to make Republicans fight with each other when they are all agreed that we need to replace this president and make him a one. You know the rest.
Gingrich has always believed in term limits, and now he just wants one for the president, which is. But no, I thought actually that was Gingrich's best line.
Absolutely, he's used it in every debate so far.
It was an obligatory slap at the media, but the media wants let's get a Perry versus Romney, but we do want to see the differences. We do want to see what they're made of, and I think we learned a lot in Wednesday's debate about who these candidates are, especially who Rick Perry is.
You know, I surely in the media people want to
see. Call you Shirley.
Yes, Shirley. I know that in the media we want to see Perry and Romney tear each other apart. But in fairness to the media, we are equally interested in seeing all eight of those candidates tear each other apart. I think Gingrich was wrong on that point. It's fine with the media to see everyone self-destruct.
And then that's where I think that Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, and Thad McConnor, the congressman from Michigan, did pretty well.
And Fred Karger, another Republican candidate for president.
Fred Karger?
Yes. His name is Fred Karger, and he is running, but he has not been able to get into any of the debates for the same reason that Thad McConnor has been denied and Gary Johnson's been denied. And Buddy Romer has been denied. And Buddy Romer is actually a guy who was governor of a state at one time. I think it's still a state. Louisiana, it's a little soggy, but it's still a state.
How's by you?
And so I say, why is he not in these debates? Because they're all sub 1% in the polls. We should probably note that the other reason we're throwing asparagus on Michelle Bachmann this week is because she lost her well-known campaign manager.
Well, I think that's less a reflection on Michelle Bachmann and more on Ed Rollins, because Ed Rollins has a history of, one, making it all about him, and two, always doing so. And I don't think he did anything wrong except for the fact that he just didn't know how to handle Rick Perry coming into the race.
He didn't seem to even anticipate.
No, I don't know.
Of course, we didn't always think he was getting in either. We used to think that Perry would stay on the sidelines.
I still think he's not going to run. But the Galileo
Ponzi
stuff.
Scheme?
The Ponzi scheme?
Well, we'll start with Ponzi scheme.
Okay.
He said,
"It is a monstrous lie. It is a Ponzi scheme to tell our kids that are 25 or 30 years old today, you're paying into a program that's going to be there. Anybody that's for the status quo with Social Security today is involved with a monstrous lie to our kids, and it's not right."
That's a pretty strong and out there position for somebody who is running for president of the United States. Certainly in our lifetimes, that's been poison.
It may not be a strong position for somebody who's trying to seek the Republican nomination in this era of...
I mean, not too strong.
Not too strong. And yet, but I thought actually Romney was correct saying, wait a second, let's not eliminate it, let's fix it.
You can't say that to tens of millions of Americans who live on Social Security and those who have lived on it. And under no circumstances would I ever say, by any measure, it's a failure. It is working for millions of Americans, and I'll keep it working for millions of Americans. And we've got to do that as a party.
And I think Huntsman and Romney and others do recognize that having a down with Social Security position in November 2012 is not going to attract many centrists and the majority of the vote.
I'd love to see what the Perry plan is for pivoting off that position once he's secured the nomination. But there were other issues as well. One of them, of course, being climate change,
right,
better known as global warming. Not a popular issue, perhaps, in Texas.
Well, scientists do debate it.
Well, there are at least a couple who still hold out for the anti-position on global warming. The interesting thing was that, looking for an example, and he was directly asked, can you name a couple of scientists that you've been reading, Governor, who tell you that climate science is bogus? Who are those scientists? He could not come up with a name, or did not come up with a name, but he then said, you know, they may be outvoted now, but Galileo was outvoted in his time.
Yeah, I think he really understands exactly what Galileo stood for back then.
Well, unfortunately, we just happen to have Galileo with us today in the studio. Well, Mr. Galileo,
it's a pleasure to be here.
Wait, before he starts, does he have a first name? Is it like Cher? Or like
yes, it was Cher Galileo.
Galileo's my first name. And if you don't mind, I'll call you Ken and Ron, all right? Well, gentlemen, I'm pleased to be here. What can I tell you?
We would like to know why it was that you could not persuade people of your theories about the universe at the time that you were first propagating them.
Well, let's step back a couple of centuries and think about the fact that when I came along, most people thought that the Earth was the center of the universe and the sun revolved around the Earth. And I did some observations that supported Copernicus's idea that actually the Earth was revolving around the sun. And this was problematic for certain members of the Catholic Church who thought that the Earth should be in the middle of the universe because we are, of course, the most important players in the universe, and Scripture says that that's the way it should be. So this became a little bit problematical, but most astronomers did come to agree with me, but there were some skeptics out there.
Among scientists?
Among astronomers, but most astronomers work for the Catholic Church, but still they were scientists, and they said, I'm not buying this. But that's the way science works. Somebody comes up with a new idea, people look at the data, and they say, yeah, this is right. And a few people say, no, I'm not ready to go. And generally speaking, things like that don't get resolved until the skeptics die off.
So the suggestion that we heard from Governor Perry that climate change, global warming is not, quote, settled science, unquote, suggesting that until 100% of scientists agreed that it was legitimate, that would not comport with your notion of how science works?
Not at all. No, you never have 100% on practically anything. But you have a really strong consensus. People look at the data, they come to an agreement. So I would say climate science is where I was when I said the sun's at the center of the solar system.
Well, thank you very much, Galileo. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Anytime.
Ron, I'm glad we cleared that up, but we didn't know what to expect from Rick Perry. We do know, we read everywhere that he seemed to have usurped Mitt Romney as the so-called front runner.
Well, in all the polls.
In all the polls. Well, and that's fair. But who do you think came out on top? I thought, in my view, Mitt Romney was the most impressive candidate in Wednesday's debate.
I thought the person I could imagine emerging from that field to be toe-to-toe with President Obama next fall in debates on stage was clearly Mitt Romney. But that may not necessarily be
the choice of the
favor.
Voters.
That's right.
Yeah.
Especially not given the attitude and given the current mood of the electorate in general, specifically the Republican Party, and even more specifically the Tea Party voters who seem to be driving the train.
And was John Huntsman running for vice president?
I thought John Huntsman was trying to put himself forward as an extremely reasonable fellow who had conservative views on economic questions, but was open-minded on other questions and certainly pro-science, as he would like to express it. And I didn't really think that he was thinking so much in terms of vice president, although clearly there are other people on that stage who might be. I think John Huntsman is trying to set himself up for reconsideration by a later electorate sometime in 2016, 2020.
Or like Democrats.
I can't imagine him running as a Democrat.
No.
But it is conceivable he could run either as an independent or as part of an independent ticket.
No.
And I don't see there's any percentage in that because you never win that way. And I think John Huntsman actually would like to be president.
Yeah, no, I do too. I kind of think that he was like appealing to the more moderate wing of the Republican Party, whatever that is. You may not see that in Iowa and South Carolina, but you would see it in states like New Hampshire and elsewhere. Good. I also thought it was interesting that of course, Ron Paul has been criticizing Rick Perry for having backed Al Gore in 1988. I thought it was interesting that Rick Perry responded in kind by saying, "You know, how could you call yourself a Reagan Republican, Ron Paul, when you left the Republican Party in 1988 because of Ronald Reagan and ran as a libertarian?" I just thought that was a waste of time, a waste of Rick Perry's time. He also went after Karl Rove.
But he was, he was firing back at the people who have been his critics from Texas. He has some rabbit ears when it comes to Texas criticism. If he hears something from Karl Rove or from somebody else in the old George W. Bush camp, that seems to get his goat in a way that all the other criticism that he's receiving does not. We should also note that in the debate, rounding out the field, were Herman Cain and Rick Santorum.
Now, once upon a time, again, I remember that it was the first debate or forum with the Republicans had, and Frank Luntz was breathlessly on Fox saying, "I thought Herman Cain was the best." I mean, we always have these great moments and bad moments for debates. We talked about how Tim Pawlenty didn't attack Mitt Romney when he should have. He got the worst of the exchange with Michelle Bachmann and had to drop out. I don't think anybody hurt their case in this week's debate, but I really think, the attention has really become a two-person race. And is it the media's fault? I mean, look, the media's focus and questions were certainly directed at Perry and Romney, but
this is where the interest is. These are the people who are getting a lot of response. I realize there's a circular reasoning in saying, well, the media are most interested in the candidates the people are most interested in, as indicated by polls, because some of that interest in the polls is driven by media attention. But at the same time, can you imagine having those eight people on stage receiving absolutely equal attention from the moderators?
You're absolutely right. And we'll have two more debates this month. We have September 12th in Tampa. We have September 22nd in Orlando. Later in that week, in Orlando week, there'll be a Florida straw poll. I don't know if the field will be narrowed by then, but I think we'll have a clearer view of where the candidates stand. And I think the imperfections that we saw from Rick Perry, obviously his handlers are talking to him about it today, and perhaps we'll see a different Rick Perry in the two debates to come.
I don't know if his problem is imperfections. I think his problem may be philosophy. If he wants to stand there and call Social Security a failure, a Ponzi scheme, and a monstrous lie, I think he's going to have a more basic problem than just an imperfection or a rough moment.
But with Republican voters, that's the question.
That is the question. We'll have to see how that affects particularly older Republican voters who have been very important to the party in recent years, much more so than in the past.
Meanwhile, we have on Thursday night, after we record this podcast,
Unfortunately,
President Obama will be talking a joint address, joint session of Congress to talk about not only jobs, but one particular job.
Yes, his own.
His.
He needs very badly to get back into the leadership game for one reason and another having to do with both deliberate choices, such as leading from behind, as it's sometimes called, with regard to the Libyan action, where we wanted NATO to take the lead on that, or, if you will, leading from behind with respect to the debt ceiling, where the president seemed to want to have that all take place without his really getting involved, other than to convene a group of people to try to work out a solution. That didn't work. He tried to deal directly with the House Speaker. That didn't work. Eventually, we wound up with that near-death experience regarding lifting the debt ceiling in the first week of August, downgrading of U.S. debt, all kinds of unhappiness and ugliness, all of which resulted in pretty bad damage for both the president and the Congress.
Absolutely. The latest poll, Wall Street Journal, NBC poll, had a 44% approval rate for President Obama, the lowest of his presidency, but 13% approval rate for Congress, which is near historic lows. Now, of course, Congress, the responsibility for running Congress is shared between the Democrats and Republicans, but I wonder if when people say the Congress, they think more of the Republican Party. Certainly during the debt ceiling crisis, as you alluded to, the Republicans took a bigger hit in the polls.
And we should say that there are some polls in which the president is doing considerably worse than he is in the Wall Street Journal NBC poll. I think the average overall is in the low 40s, but he has had a gallop under 40. He's been down to 39% in the midst of all this. And part of that, I think, is the perception that he has absented himself from some of the really big problems that the nation faces in the last several months. And then on top of that, when he has taken stronger positions, they have been upsetting to elements of his base. Most particularly his backing off some of the clean air rules that he was trying to have the EPA enforce. They were objected to by a lot of people in industry saying it was going to cost jobs. The president decided it might cost jobs. Jobs are more important right now. We're going to back off on enforcement of those tougher rules. And that, of course, brought a howl from the environmental community.
But I feel there's a feeling that this is really, in the Republican Party, that this is more of a political speech than anything else, that no new ideas are likely to be unveiled. Yes, there is a lack of confidence in Washington, and yes, people are more fed up with Washington than ever, and yet next week it seems like there are at least two more people who would like to come to Washington.
Yes, there are a couple of congresspersons to be, and one of whom I think we can more or less anoint, Mark Amade in Nevada. Looks like he's not going to have any trouble at all taking over Dean Heller's seat.
And Dean Heller became a senator after to replace John Ensign. This is the second congressional district in Nevada, and it's most of the state aside from Las Vegas.
90% of the state.
It was created in 1982, and the Republicans have held it ever since. The Democratic nominee is Kate Marshall, the state treasurer, who's doing basically everything she can to distance herself from the Democratic Party. But I think in this climate, I think the Republicans hold on to this seat. It's not going to be a referendum on anything. Of course, the Republicans would love it to be a referendum on President Obama. This is a Republican district, a rural district, and as I said, the Democrats have never won it.
Okay, so not a big referendum perhaps in Nevada, not a big surprise, but a big surprise could be brewing in New York City.
Well, as solidly Republican as Nevada, too, is New York 9, of course, there's a lot of new configurations of
this
it.
This is Brooklyn, Queens.
Well, now it's two-thirds Queens and half Brooklyn, exactly. But, I mean, if you look at the people who have held that district, I mean, it was Anthony Weiner until he resigned. Before that, it was Chuck Schumer. It was Elizabeth Holzman. It was, going back to 1066, Emanuel Seller. So his brother Wine. So, you know, the point is this seat has always been held by the Democratic Party going back to, you know, the beginning of time, even though the district lines have changed. But the Democrats are nervous about this.
Are they more nervous about it because of Bob Turner, the Republican who's never been elected to anything and who was beaten by 20-some points last time he ran against Anthony Weiner? Or are they more nervous about it because of David Weprin? Democrat.
Well, that's it. He's just made a lot of mistakes. He canceled on a debate when he shouldn't have. Ed Koch has endorsed Bob Turner, the Republican, because he feels that Weprin, who's an Orthodox Jew, is not sufficiently pro-Israel.
I believe that gay marriage is also a large issue here,
yes.
That some of the Orthodox Jews in the district are very unhappy with David Weprin for voting for the gay marriage bill legislature.
I think the Democrats hold on to that seat.
Not by much, though. The polls are very close.
I mean, I think the Democrats hold it, but the closer it gets, the more nervous the Democrats get. And again, for all we know, this district can disappear in 2012 because New York loses two seats, and I assume that because of the least seniority, New York 9 may not exist in the next census.
It is a battle for a very short period of time payoff. And if you're right, if the Democrats are going to pull that out, a lot of that's going to rest on Governor Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo has gotten in the race. Apparently, his father and David Weprin's father, Saul, were close political associates, and Andrew Cuomo has taken it upon himself to make some ads for Weprin.
Unions have put in tons of money as well on behalf of Weprin.
You know, bottom line on New York 9 is that Dave Weprin has been going around telling people, look, it's my name on the ballot, not Barack Obama. Even Andrew Cuomo has said, look, there are two names on that ballot and neither one of them is Barack Obama. This doesn't have to do with the president. And sort of like the check is in the mail and it's not about the money, when you hear politicians saying, look, that guy's name is not on the ballot, this doesn't have anything to do with him, it means it has to do with him.
But what's remarkable about that, you know, usually you hear that in blue dog districts.
Right.
Like Heath Shuler's really not...
In North Carolina.
In North Carolina, he's really not working with Barack Obama. To hear that in Brooklyn and Queens just lets you know how uniformly unique this election is. And again, I think the Democrats win it, but we'll see how close it is.
We will indeed. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rutan.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics on NPR.
Ron, who was Galileo, by the way?
Oh, and a big thank you to the NPR Science Desk for loaning us Richard Harris.
What was Galileo's first name?
Sure.
Galileo. 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 Magnifico.